his eyes, which were burning from all the smoke. He almost dropped the bong, but Chef rescued it.
Holy shit, that's an airplane.
Andy tried to get up, but his legs, although buzzing with energy, wouldn't hold him. He settled back.
No, Sanders, Chef said.
He puffed at the bong. Sitting with legs akimbo as he was, he looked to Andy like an Indian with a peace pipe. Leaning on the side of the shed between Andy and Chef were four full-auto AK-47s, Russian in manufacture but imported, like many other fine items stocked in the storage facility, from China. There were also five stack crates filled with 30-round clips and a box of RGD-5 grenades. Chef had offered Andy a translation of the ideograms on the box of grenades. Do not drop this, motherfucker. Now, Chef took one of the AKs and laid it across his knees.
That was not an airplane, he amplified.
No, then what was it?
A sign from God.
Chef looked at what he had painted on the side of the storage barn. Two quotes, liberally interpreted, from the Book of Revelation with the number 31 featured prominently. Then he looked back at Andy. To the north, the plume of smoke in the sky was dissipating. Below it, fresh smoke was rising from where the plane had impacted in the woods.
I got the date wrong, he said in a brooding voice. Halloween really is coming early this year. Maybe today. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe the day after tomorrow.
Or the day after that, Andy added helpfully.
Maybe, Chef allowed, but I think it'll be sooner. Sanders?
What, Chef?
Take you a gun. You're in the Lord's army now. You're a Christian soldier. Your days of licking that apostate son of a bitch's ass are over.
Andy took an AK and laid it across his bare thighs. He liked the weight of it and the warmth of it. He checked to make sure the safety was on. It was.
What apostate son of a bitch are you talking about, Chef?
Chef fixed him with a look of utter contempt, but when Andy reached for the bong, he handed it over willingly enough. There was plenty for both of them. Would be from now until the end, and yea, verily, the end would not be long.
Rennie, that apostate son of a bitch.
He's my friend, my pal, but he can be a hard ass, all right, Andy admitted. My goodness, but this is good shit.
It is,
Chef agreed moodily, and took the bong, which Andy now thought of as the smoke'em peace pipe, back.
It's the longest of long glass, the purest of the pure. And what is it, Sanders?
A medicine for melancholy, Andy returned smartly.
And what is that?
Pointing at the new black mark on the dome.
A sign from God.
Yes, Chef said, mollified. That's exactly what it is. We're on a God trip now, Sanders. Do you know what happened when God opened the seventh seal? Have you read Revelation?
Andy had a memory from the Christian camp he'd attended as a teenager of angels popping out of that seventh seal like clowns from the little car at the circus. But he didn't want to say it that way. Chef might consider it blasphemous. So he just shook his head.
Thought not, Chef said.
You might have gotten preaching at Holy Redeemer, but preaching is not education. Preaching is not the true visionary shit. Do you understand that? What Andy understood was that he wanted another hit, but he nodded his head.
When the seventh seal was opened, seven angels appeared with seven trumpets, and each time one blew the boogie, a plague smote down on the earth. Here, toke this shit, it'll help your concentration.
How long had they been out here smoking? It seemed like hours. Had they really seen a plane crash? Andy thought so, but now he wasn't completely sure. It seemed awfully far-fetched. Maybe he should take a nap. On the other hand, it was wonderful to the point of ecstasy just to be out here with Chef, getting stoned and educated.
I almost killed myself, but God saved me, he told Chef.
The thought was so wonderful that tears filled his eyes.
Yeah, that's obvious. This other stuff isn't, so listen.
I am.
First angel blew and hailed down blood on the earth.
second angel blew, and a mountain of fire was cast into the sea. That's your volcanoes and shit.
Yes,
Andy shouted, and inadvertently squeezed the trigger of the AK-47 lying across his lap.
You want to watch that, Chef said. If the safety hadn't been on, you would have blown my tickle stick into yonder pine tree. Hit on this shit.
He handed Andy the bong. Andy couldn't even remember giving it back to him, but he must have done. And what time was it? It looked like mid-afternoon, but how could that be? He hadn't gotten hungry for lunch, and he always got hungry for lunch. It was his best meal.
Now listen, Sanders, because this is the important part.
Chef was able to quote from memory because he had made quite a study of the Book of Revelations since moving out here to the radio station. He read and reread it obsessively, sometimes until dawn streaked the horizon.
And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as if it were a lamp.
We just saw that.
Chef nodded. His eyes were fixed on the black smudge where Aer Lingus 179 had met her end.
And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And many men died because they were made bitter. Are you bitter, Sanders?
No, Andy assured him.
No, we're mellow. But now that star Wormwood has blazed in the sky, bitter men will come. God has told me this, Sanders, and it's no bullshit. Check me out and you find I'm all about zero bullshit. They're gonna try to take all this away from us. Rennie and his bullshit cronies.
No way, Andy cried.
A sudden and horribly intense paranoia swept over him. They could be here already. Bullshit cronies creeping through those trees. Bullshit cronies driving down Little Bitch Road in a line of trucks. Now that Chef had brought it up, he even saw why Rennie would want to do it. He'd call it getting rid of the evidence.
Chef,
he gripped his new friend's shoulder.
Let up a little, Sanders, that hurts.
He let up a little.
Big Jim's already talked about coming up and getting the propane tanks. That's the first step.
Chef nodded.
They've already been here once. Took two tanks. I let them.
He paused, then patted the grenades.
I won't let him again. Are you down with that?
Andy thought of the pounds of dope inside the building they were leaning against, and gave the answer Chef had expected.
My brother,
he said, and embraced Chef. Chef was hot and stinky, but Andy hugged with enthusiasm. Tears were rolling down his face, which he had neglected to shave on a weekday for the first time in over 20 years. This was great. This was bonding.
My brother,
he sobbed into Chef's ear. Chef thrust him back and looked at him solemnly.
We are agents of the Lord, he said.
And Andy Sanders, now all alone in the world, except for the scrawny prophet beside him, said, Amen. 23. Jackie found Ernie Calvert behind his house, weeding his garden. She was a little worried about approaching him in spite of what she'd told Piper, but she needn't have been. He gripped her shoulders with hands that were surprisingly strong for such a portly little man. His eyes shone.
Thank God someone sees what that windbag's up to.
He dropped his hands. Sorry, I smudged your blouse.
That's all right.
He's dangerous, Officer Weddington. You know that, don't you?
Yes.
And clever. He set up that damn food riot up the way a terrorist would plant a bomb.
I have no doubt of it.
But he's also stupid. Clever and stupid is a terrible combination. You can persuade people to go with you, you see, all the way to hell. Look at that fellow Jim Jones. Remember him?
The one who got all his followers to drink poison?
So you'll come to the meeting? You bet. And mum's the word. Unless you want me to talk to Lissa Jameson, that is. Glad to do it.
Before Jackie could answer, her cell phone rang. It was her personal. She had turned in the one issued to her by the PD along with her badge and gun.
Hello, this is Jackie.
Mihi portato vulnerato, Sergeant Weddington,
an unfamiliar voice said. The motto of her old unit in Würzburg.
Bring us your wounded.
And Jackie responded without even thinking,
On stretchers, crutches, or in bags. We put him together with spit and rags. Who the hell is this?
Colonel James Cox, Sergeant.
Jackie moved the phone away from her mouth. Give me a minute, Ernie. He nodded and went back to his garden.
Jackie strolled toward the shake pole fence at the foot of the yard.
What can I do for you, Colonel, and is this line secure?
Sergeant, if your man Rennie can tap cell phone calls made from beyond the dome, we're in a world of hurt.
He's not my man.
Good to know.
And I'm no longer in the army. The 67th isn't even in my rearview mirror these days, sir.
Well, that's not exactly true, Sarge. By order of the President of the United States, you've been stop-lost. Welcome back.
Sir, I don't know whether to say thank you or fuck you very much.
Cox laughed without much humor. Jack Reacher says hello.
Is that where you got this number?
That and a recommendation. A recommendation from Reacher goes a long way. You ask what you can do for me, the answer is twofold, both parts simple. One, get Dale Barbara out of the mess he's in. Unless you think he's guilty of the charges.
No, sir, I'm sure he's not. That is to say, we are. There are several of us.
Good. Very good.
There was no mistaking the relief in the man's voice.
Number two. You can knock that bastard Rennie off his perch.
That would be Barbie's job. If you're positive this line's secure.
Positive.
If we can get him out.
That's in the works, is it?
Yes, sir. I believe so.
Excellent. How many brown shirts does Rennie have?
Currently about 30, but he's still hiring. And here in the mill, they're blue shirts, but I take your meaning. Don't sell him short, Colonel. He's got most of this town in his pocket. We're going to try to get Barbie out. And you better hope we succeed, because I can't do much about Big Jim on my own. Toppling dictators with no help from the outside world is about 6 miles above my pay grade. And just FYI, my own days on the Chester's Mill PD are over. Rennie shit-canned me.
Keep me informed when and as you can. Spring Barbara and turn your resistance operation over to him. We'll see who ends up getting shit-canned.
Sir, you sort of wish you were in here, don't you?
With all my heart.
No hesitation.
I'd de-wheel that son of a bitch's little red wagon in about 12 hours.
Jackie doubted that, actually. Things were different under the dome. Outsiders couldn't understand. Even time was different. 5 days ago, everything had been normal. Now look.
One other thing, Colonel Cox said. Take some time out of your busy schedule to look at the TV. We're going to do our level best to make Rennie's life uncomfortable.
Jackie said goodbye and broke the connection. Then she walked back to where Ernie was gardening. Got a generator? She asked.
Died last night, he said with sour good cheer.
Well, let's go someplace where there's a working TV. My friend says we should check out the news.
They headed for Sweetbriar Rose. On their way, they met Julia Shumway and brought her along. Busted.
1. Sweetbriar was closed until 5 p.m., at which time Rose planned to offer a light supper, mostly leftovers. She was making potato salad and keeping an eye on the TV over the counter when the knocking on the door started. It was Jackie Weddington, Ernie Calvert, and Julia Shumway. Rose crossed the empty restaurant, wiping her hands on her apron, and unlocked the door.
Horace the Corgi trotted at Julia's heels, ears up, grinning companionably. Rose made sure the close sign was still in place, then relocked the door behind them.
Thanks, Jackie said. Not at all, Rose replied. I wanted to see you anyway.
We came for that, Jackie said and pointed to the TV. I was at Ernie's and we met Julia on our way here.
She was sitting across the street from her place, mooning at the wreckage.
I was not mooning, Julia said.
Horace and I were trying to figure out how we're going to get a paper out after the town meeting. It'll have to be small, probably just 2 pages, but there will be a paper. My heart is set on it.
Rose glanced back at the TV.
On it, a pretty young woman was doing a stand-up. Beneath her was a banner reading, Earlier Today, Courtesy ABC. All at once, there was a bang and a fireball bloomed in the sky. The reporter flinched, cried out, wheeled around. By that point, her cameraman was already zooming her out of the picture.
homing in on the earthbound fragments of the Aer Lingus jet.
There's nothing but reruns of the plane crash footage, Rose said. If you haven't seen it before, be my guest.
Jackie, I saw Barbie late this morning. I took him some sandwiches and they let me go downstairs to where the cells are. I had Melvin Searles as my chaperone.
Lucky you, Jackie said.
How is he? Julia asked. Is he okay?
He looks like the wrath of God, but I think so, yes.
He said, maybe I should tell you privately, Jackie.
Whatever it is, I think you can say it in front of Ernie and Julia.
Rose considered this, but only for a moment. If Ernie Calvert and Julia Shumway weren't all right, nobody was.
He said I was supposed to talk to you, make up with you, as if we'd had a fight. He said to tell you that I'm all right.
Jackie turned to Ernie and Julia. It seemed to Rose that a question was asked and answered.
If Barbie says you are, then you are,
Jackie said, and Ernie nodded emphatically.
Hun, we're putting together a little meeting tonight at the Congo Parsonage. It's kind of a secret.
Not kind of, it is, Julia said. And given the way things are in town right now, the secret better not get out.
If it's about what I think it's about, I'm in.
Then Rose lowered her voice.
But not Anson. He's wearing one of those goddamn armbands.
Just then the CNN Breaking News logo came on the TV screen, accompanied by the annoying minor key disaster music the network was now playing with each new dome story. Rose expected either Anderson Cooper or her beloved Wolfie. Both were now based in Castle Rock. But it was Barbara Starr, the network's Pentagon correspondent. She was standing outside the tent and trailer village serving as the Army's forward base in Harlow.
Don Kyra, Colonel James O. Cox, the Pentagon's point man since the mammoth mystery known as the Dome came into being last Saturday, is about to speak to the press for only the second time since this crisis began. The subject was announced to reporters just moments ago, and it's sure to galvanize the tens of thousands of Americans with loved ones in the beleaguered town of Chester's Mill. We were told...
She listened to something in her earpiece.
Here's Colonel Cox.
The four in the restaurant sat on stools at the counter, watching as the picture switched to the inside of a large tent. There were perhaps 40 reporters seated in folding chairs, and more standing in the back. They were murmuring among themselves. A makeshift stage had been set up at one end of the tent. On it was a podium festooned with microphones and flanked by American flags. There was a white screen behind it.
Pretty professional for an on-the-fly operation, Ernie said.
Oh, I think this has been in the works, Jackie said. She was recalling her conversation with Cox.
We're going to do our level best to make Rennie's life uncomfortable, he'd said. A flap opened to the left side of the tent, and a short, fit-looking man with graying hair strode briskly to the makeshift stage. No one had thought to put down a couple of stairs or even a box to stand on, but this presented no problem to the featured speaker. He hopped up easily, not even breaking stride. He was dressed in plain khaki BDUs. If he had medals, they weren't in evidence. There was nothing on his shirt but a strip reading Colonel J. Cox. He held no notes. The reporters quieted immediately, and Cox gave them a little smile.
This guy should have been holding press conferences all along, Julia said. He looks good.
Hush, Julia, Rose said.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming, Cox said. I'll be brief and then I'll take a few questions. The situation as regards Chester's Mill and what we're all now calling the Dome is as it was. The town continues to be cut off. We still have no idea about what is causing this situation or what brought it about. And we have as yet had no success in breaching the barrier. You would know, of course, if we had. The best scientists in America, the best in the entire world, are on the case, however, and we're considering a number of options. Do not ask me about these because you'll get no answers at this time.
The reporters murmured discontentedly. Cox let them. Below him, the CNN super switched to no answers at this time. When the murmuring died, Cox went on.
As you're aware, we have established a no-go zone around the dome, initially of a mile, expanded to 2 on Sunday, and 4 on Tuesday. There were a number of reasons for this, the most important being that the dome is dangerous to people with certain implants,
such as pacemakers. The second reason is that we were concerned the field generating the dome might have other harmful effects, which would be less clearly recognized.
Are you talking about radiation, Colonel?
Someone called. Cox froze him with a glance, and when he seemed to consider the reporter properly chastised, not Wolfie, Rose was pleased to see, but that half-bald no-spin yapper from Fox News. He went on. We now believe that there are no harmful effects, at least in the short term, and so we have designated Friday, October 27th, the day after tomorrow, as Visitor's Day at the Dome. A perfect fury of thrown questions went up at this. Cox waited it out, and when the audience had quieted down, he took a remote from the shelf under the podium and pressed a button. A high-resolution photograph, much too good to have been downloaded from Google Earth in Julia's estimation, popped up on the white screen. It showed the mill and both towns to the south, Mauton and Castle Rock. Cox put down the controller and produced a laser pointer. The super at the bottom of the screen now read Friday, designated Visitor's Day at the Dome. Julia smiled. Colonel Cox had caught CNN with its spell checker down. We believe we can process and accommodate 1,200 visitors, Cox said crisply. These will be limited to close relatives at least this time. And all of us hope and pray there will never have to be a next time. Rally points will be here at the Castle Rock Fairgrounds and here at Oxford Plains Speedway. He highlighted both locations. We will lay on 24 buses, 12 at each location. These will be provided by 6 surrounding school districts, which are canceling classes that day to help in this effort, and we offer them our greatest thanks. A 25th bus will be available for press at Shiner's Bait and Tackle in Mauton. Dryly. Since Shiner's is also an agency liquor store, I'm sure most of you know it, there will also be one video truck allowed on this trip. You'll arrange pool coverage, ladies and gentlemen, the coverage provider to be chosen by lottery. A groan went up at this, but it was perfunctory. There are 48 seats on the press bus, and obviously there are hundreds of press representatives here from all over the world. Thousands! A gray-haired man shouted, and there was general laughter. Boy, I'm glad someone's having fun, Ernie Calvert said bitterly. Cox allowed himself a smile. I stand corrected, Mr. Gregory. Seats will be allocated according to your news organization. TV networks, Reuters, TASS, AP, and so on. And it's up to those organizations to pick their representatives.
Better be Wolfie from CNN, that's all I can say, Rose announced.
The reporters were babbling excitedly. May I go on? Cox asked. And those of you sending text messages, kindly stop.
Ooh, Jackie said. I love a forceful man.
Surely you folks recall that you're not the story here. Would you behave this way if it was a mine cave-in or people trapped under collapsed buildings after an earthquake?
Silence greeted this. The kind that falls over a fourth-grade class after the teacher finally loses his temper.
He really was forceful, Julia thought, and for a moment wished with all her heart that Cox were here under the dome and in charge. But, of course, if pigs had wings, bacon would be airborne. Your job, ladies and gentlemen, is twofold, to help us get the word out, and to make sure that things go smoothly on Visitor's Day once it does. The CNN super became press to aid visitors on Friday. The last thing we want to do is start a stampede of relations from all over the country to Western Maine. We've already got close to 10,000 relatives of those trapped under the dome in this immediate area. The hotels, motels, and camping areas are full to bursting. The message to relatives in other parts of the country is, if you're not here, don't come. Not only will you not be granted a visitor's pass, you'll be turned around at checkpoints here, 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 and here. He highlighted Lewiston, Auburn, North Windham, and Conway, New Hampshire. Relatives currently in the area should proceed to registration officers who are already standing by at the fairgrounds and the speedway. If you're planning to jump into your car right this minute, don't. This isn't the Filene's white sale, and being first in line guarantees you nothing. Visitors will be chosen by lottery, and you must register to get in. Those applying to visit will need 2 photo IDs. We'll attempt to give priority to visitors with 2 or more relatives in the mill, but
No promises on that. And a warning, people. If you show up on Friday to board one of the buses and you have no pass, or a counterfeit pass, if you clog up our operation, in other words, you'll find yourself in jail. Do not test us on this. Embarkation on Friday morning will commence at 0800 hours. If this goes smoothly, you'll have at least 4 hours with your loved ones, maybe longer. Gum up the works and everyone's time, dome side goes down. Buses will depart the dome at 1700 hours.
What's the visitor's site?
A woman shouted. I was just getting to that, Andrea.
Cox picked up his controller and zoomed in on Route 119. Jackie knew the area well. She had damn near broken her nose on the dome out there. She could see the roofs of the Dinsmore farmhouse, outbuildings, and dairy barns.
There's a flea market site on the Motton side of the dome.
Cox binged it with his pointer.
The buses will park there. Visitors will debark and walk to the dome. There's plenty of field on both sides where people can gather. All the wreckage out there has been removed.
Will the visitors be allowed to go all the way up to the dome?
A reporter asked. Cox once more faced the camera, addressing the potential visitors directly. Rose could just imagine the hope and fear those people, watching in bars and motel TVs, listening on their car radios, must be feeling right now. She felt plenty of both herself.
Visitors will be allowed within 2 yards of the dome, Cox said. We consider that a safe distance, although we make no guarantees. This isn't an amusement park ride that's been safety tested. People with electronic implants must stay away. You're on your own with that. We can't check each and every chest for a pacemaker scar. Visitors will also leave all electronic devices, including, but not limited to, iPods, cell phones, and Blackberries on the buses. Reporters with mics and cameras will be kept at a distance. The close-up space is for the visitors, and what goes on between them and their loved ones is no one's business but their own. People, this will work if you help us make it work. If I can put it in Star Trek terms, help us make it so.
He put the pointer down.
Now, I'll take a few questions. A very few. Mr. Blitzer?
Rose's face lit up. She raised a fresh cup of coffee and toasted the TV screen with it.
Looking good, Wolfie. You can eat crackers in my bed anytime you want.
Colonel Cox, are there any plans to add a press conference with the town officials? We understand that Second Selectman James Rennie is the actual man in charge. What's going on with that?
We are trying to make a press conference happen with Mr. Rennie and any other town officials who might be in attendance. That would be at noon, if things run to the schedule we have in mind.
A round of spontaneous applause from the reporters greeted this. There was nothing they liked better than a press conference, unless it was a high-priced politician caught in bed with a high-priced whore.
Cox said, ideally the presser will take place right there on the road with the town spokespersons, whoever they might be, on their side, and you, ladies and gentlemen, on this one. Excited gabble. They liked the visual possibilities.
Cox pointed.
Mr. Holt. Lester Holt from NBC shot to his feet.
How sure are you that Mr. Rennie will attend? I ask because there have been reports of financial mismanagement on his part, and some sort of criminal investigation into his affairs by the State of Maine Attorney General.
I've heard those reports, Cox said. I'm not prepared to comment on them, although Mr. Rennie may want to.
He paused, not quite smiling.
I'd certainly want to.
Rita Braver, Colonel Cox, CBS. Is it true that Dale Barbara, the man you tapped as emergency administrator in Chester's Mill, has been arrested for murder? That the Chester's Mill police, in fact, believe him to be a serial killer?
Total silence from the press. Nothing but attentive eyes. The same was true of the four people seated at the counter in Sweetbriar Rose.
It's true, Cox said.
A muted mutter went up from the assembled reporters.
But we have no way of verifying the charges or vetting whatever evidence there may be. What we have is the same telephone and internet chatter you ladies and gentlemen are no doubt getting. Dale Barbara is a decorated officer. He's never been arrested. I have known him for many years and vouched for him to the President of the United States. I have no reason to say I made a mistake based on what I know at this time.
Ray Suarez, Colonel, PBS.
Do you believe the charges against Lieutenant Barbara, now Colonel Barbara, may have been politically motivated? That James Rennie may have had him jailed to keep him from taking control, as the president ordered?
And that's what the second half of this dog and pony show is all about, Julia realized. Cox has turned the news media into the voice of America, and we're the people behind the Berlin Wall. She was all admiration.
If you have a chance to question Selectman Rennie on Friday, Mr. Suarez, you be sure to ask him that.
Cox spoke with a kind of stony calm.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all I have.
He strode off as briskly as he'd entered. And before the assembled reporters could even begin shouting more questions, he was gone.
Holy wow, Ernie murmured.
Yeah, Jackie said. Rose killed the TV. She looked glowing, energized. What time is this meeting? I don't regret a thing that Colonel Cox said, but this could make Barbie's life more difficult.
2.
Barbie found out about Cox's press conference when a red-faced Manuel Ortega came downstairs and told him. Ortega, formerly Alden Dinsmore's hired man, was now wearing a blue work shirt, a tin badge that looked homemade, and a .45 hung on a second belt that had been buckled low on his hips, gunslinger style. Barbie knew him as a mild fellow with thinning hair and perpetually sunburned skin who liked to order breakfast for dinner, pancakes, bacon, eggs over easy, and talk about cows, his favorite being the belted Galloways that he could never persuade Mr. Dinsmore to buy. He was Yankee to the core in spite of his name, and had a dry Yankee sense of humor. Barbie had always liked him. But this was a different Manuel. A stranger, with all the good humor boiled dry. He brought news of the latest development, most of it shouted through the bars and accompanied by a considerable dose of flying spit. His face was nearly radioactive with rage.
Not a word about how they found your dog tags on that poor girl's hand. Not one fucking word about that. And then the tin pants bastard went and took after Jim Rennie, who's held this town together by himself since this happened. By himself! With spit and baling wire.
Take it easy, Manuel, Barbie said.
That's Officer Ortega to you, motherfucker.
Fine, Officer Ortega. Barbie was sitting on the bunk and thinking about just how easy it would be for Ortega to unholster the elderly .45 Schofield on his belt and start shooting. I'm in here, Rennie's out there. As far as he's concerned, I'm sure it's all good.
Shut up! Manuel screamed. We're all in here. All under the fucking dome. Alden don't do nothing but drink. The boy that's left won't eat, and Ms. Dinsmore never stops crying over Rory. Jack Evans blew his brains out. Do you know that? And those military pukes out there can't think of anything better to do than sling mud. A lot of lies and trumped-up stories while you start supermarket riots, and then burn down our newspaper, probably so Ms. Sumway couldn't publish what you are.
Barbie kept silent. He thought that one word spoken in his own defense would get him shot for sure.
This is how they get any politician they don't like, Manuel said. They want a serial killer and a rapist, one who rapes the dead, in charge instead of a Christian. That's a new low.
Manuel drew his gun, lifted it, pointed it through the bars. To Barbie, the hole at the end looked as big as a tunnel entrance.
If the dome comes down before you've been stood up against the nearest wall and ventilated, Manuel continued, I'll take a minute to do the job myself. I'm head of the line, and right now in the mill, the line waiting to do you is a long one.
Barbie kept silent and waited to die, or keep on drawing breath. Rose Twitchell's BLTs were trying to crowd back up his throat and choke him.
We're trying to survive, and all they can do is dirty up the man who's keeping this town out of chaos.
He abruptly shoved the oversized pistol back into its holster.
Fuck you. You're not worth it.
He turned and strode back toward the stairs, head down and shoulders hunched. Barbie leaned back against the wall and let out a breath. There was sweat on his forehead. The hand he lifted to wipe it off was shaking. 3. When Romeo Burpee's van turned into the McClatchy driveway, Claire rushed out of the house. She was weeping. "Mom!" Joe shouted, and was out even before Romy could come to a complete stop. The others piled out after.
"Mom, what's wrong?"
"Nothing," Claire sobbed, grabbing him and hugging him. "There's going to be a visitor's day. On Friday, Joey, I think we might get to see a dad." Joe let out a cheer and danced around her. Benny hugged Nori and took the opportunity to steal a quick kiss, Rusty observed. Cheeky little devil. "Take me to the hospital, Romy," Rusty said. He waved to Claire and the kids as they backed down the driveway. He was glad to get away from Mrs. McClatchy without having to talk to her. Mom vision might work on PAs as well.
"And could you do me a favor and talk English instead of that comic book on Parl shit while you do it?"
"Some people have no cultural heritage to fall back on," Romy said, "and are thus jealous of those who do."
"Yeah, and your mother wears galoshes," Rusty said.
"That's true, but only when it rains, huh?"
Rusty's cell phone chimed once, a text message. He flipped it open and read, "Meeting at 21:30. Congo Parsonage. Be there or be square. J.W.
"Romy," he said, closing his phone, "assuming I survive the Rennies, would you consider attending a meeting with me tonight?" 4. At the hospital, Ginny met him in the lobby.
"It's Rennie Day at Kathy Russell," she announced, looking as if this did not exactly displease her. "Thurse Marshall has been in to see them both. Rusty, that man, is a gift from God. He clearly doesn't like Junior. He and Frankie were the ones who roughed him up out of the pond, but he was totally professional. The guy's wasted in some college English department. He should be doing this." She lowered her voice. "He's better than me, and way better than Twitch."
"Where is he now?"
"Went back to where he's living to see that young girlfriend of his and the two children they took on.
He seems to genuinely care about the kids, too."
"Oh, my goodness, Ginny's in love," Rusty said, grinning.
"Don't be juvenile," she glared at him.
"What rooms are the Rennies in?"
"Junior in 7, senior in 19. Senior came in with that guy Thibodeau, but must have sent him off to run errands, because he was on his own when he went down to see his kid." She smiled cynically. "He didn't visit long. Mostly he's been on that cell phone of his. The kid just sits. Although he's rational again. He wasn't when Henry Morrison brought him in."
"Big Jim's arrhythmia. How are we with that?"
"Thurston got it quieted down."
"For the time being," Rusty thought. And not without satisfaction. When the Valium wears off, he'll recommence the old cardiac jitterbug.
"Go see the kid first," Ginny said. They were alone in the lobby, but she kept her voice low-pitched. "I don't like him. I've never liked him. But I feel sorry for him now. I don't think he's got long."
"Did Thurston say anything about Junior's condition to Rennie?"
"Yes, that the problem was potentially serious. But apparently not as serious as all those calls he's making. Probably someone told him about Visitor's Day on Friday. Rennie's pissed about it." Rusty thought of the box on Black Ridge. Just a thin rectangle, with an area of less than 50 square inches. And still, he hadn't been able to lift it, or even budge it. He also thought of the laughing leatherheads he'd briefly glimpsed.
"Some people just don't approve of visitors," he said.
5.
"How are you feeling, Junior?"
"Okay. Better." He sounded listless. He was wearing a hospital johnny and sitting by the window. The light was merciless on his haggard face. He looked like a road-hard 40-year-old.
"Tell me what happened before you passed out."
"I was going to school, then I went to Angie's house instead. I wanted to tell her to make it up with Frank. He's been majorly bumming."
Rusty considered asking if Junior knew Frank and Angie were both dead. Then didn't. What was the point?
Instead, he asked,
"You were going to school? What about the dome?"
"Oh, right." The same listless, affectless voice. "I forgot about that."
"How old are you, son?"
21.
"What was your mother's name?" Junior considered this.
"Jason Gamby," he said at last, then laughed shrilly. But the listless, haggard expression on his face never changed.
"When did the dome drop down?"
"Saturday."
"And how long ago was that?" Junior frowned.
"A week," he said at last. "Then 2 weeks. It's been a while, for sure."
He turned at last to Rusty. His eyes were shining with the Valium thirst Marshall had injected.
"Did Barbie put you up to all these questions?"
"He killed them,
you know."
He nodded.
"We found his gog bags."
A pause.
"Dog tags."
"Barbie didn't put me up to anything," Rusty said. "He's in jail."
"Pretty soon he'll be in hell,"
Junior said with dry matter-of-factness.
"We're going to try him?"
"And execute him. My dad said so. There's no death penalty in Maine, but he says these are wartime conditions. Egg salad has too many calories."
"That's true," Rusty said. He had brought a stethoscope, a blood pressure cuff, and an ophthalmoscope. Now he wrapped the cuff around Junior's arm. "Can you name the last three presidents in order, Junior?"
"Sure. Bush, push, and tush."
He laughed wildly, but still with no facial expression. Junior's BP was 147 over 120. Rusty had been prepared for worse.
"Do you remember who came in to see you before I did?"
"Yeah. The old guy me and Frankie found at the pond just before we found the kids. I hope those kids are all right. They were totally cute."
"Do you remember their names?"
"Aiden and Alice Appleton. We went to the club, and that girl with the red hair jerked me off under the table. Thought she was going to ferret right off before she was fun."
A pause.
"Done."
"Uh-huh."
Rusty employed the ophthalmoscope. Junior's right eye was fine. The optic disc of the left was bulging. A condition known as papilledema. It was a common symptom of advanced brain tumors and the attendant swelling.
"See anything green, McQueen?"
"Nope."
Rusty put the ophthalmoscope down, then held his index finger in front of Junior's face.
"I want you to touch my finger with your finger, then touch your nose." Junior did so.
Rusty began to move his finger slowly back and forth.
"Keep going."
Junior succeeded in going from the moving finger to his nose once. Then he hit the finger but touched his cheek instead. The third time, he missed the finger and touched his right eyebrow.
"Booyah! You want more? I can do it all day, you know."
"I'm going to send Ginny Tomlinson in with a prescription for you."
"After I get it, can I go roam? Home, I mean."
"You're staying overnight with us, Junior, for observation."
"But I'm all right, aren't I? I had one of my headaches before. I mean, a real blinder, but it's gone. I'm okay, right?"
"I can't tell you anything right now," Rusty said. "I want to talk with Thurston Marshall and look at some books."
"Man, that guy's no doctor. He's an English teacher."
"Maybe so, but he treated you okay. Better than you and Frank treated him, is my understanding." Junior waved a dismissing hand.
"We were just playing. Besides, we treated those rids tight, didn't we?"
"Can't argue with you there. For now, Junior, just relax. Watch some TV, why don't you?"
Junior considered this, then asked,
"What's for supper?"
6.
Under the circumstances, the only thing Rusty could think of to reduce the swelling in what passed for Junior Rennie's brain was IV mannitol. He pulled the chart out of the door and saw a note attached to it in an unfamiliar looping scrawl. "Dear Dr. Everett,
What do you think about mannitol for this patient? I cannot order. Have no idea of the correct amount. Thirse. Rusty jotted down the dose. Ginny was right. Thurston Marshall was good. 7. The door to Big Jim's room was open, but the room was empty. Rusty heard the man's voice coming from the late Dr. Haskell's favorite snoozery. Rusty walked down to the lounge. He did not think to take Big Jim's chart, an oversight he would come to regret. Big Jim was fully dressed and sitting by the window with his phone to his ear, even though the sign on the wall showed a bright red cell phone with a red X over it for the reading impaired. Rusty thought it would give him great pleasure to order Big Jim to terminate his call. It might not be the most politic way to start what was going to be a combination exam discussion, but he meant to do it. He started forward, then stopped. Cold. A clear memory arose. Not being able to sleep, getting up for a piece of Linda's cranberry orange bread, hearing Audrey whining softly from the girls' room, going down there to check the J's, sitting on Jenny's bed beneath Hannah Montana, her guardian angel. Why had this memory been so slow in coming? Why not during his meeting with Big Jim in Big Jim's home study? Because then I didn't know about the murders, I was fixated on the propane. And because Janelle wasn't having a seizure, she was just in REM sleep. Talking in her sleep. He has a golden baseball, Daddy. It's a bad baseball. Even last night in the mortuary, that memory hadn't resurfaced. Only now, when it was 2:30 late. But think what it means. That gadget up on Black Ridge may only be putting out limited radiation, but it's broadcasting something else. Call it induced precognition. Call it something that doesn't even have a name. But whatever you call it, it's there. And if Jenny was right about the golden baseball, then all the kids who've been making Sybil-like pronouncements about a Halloween disaster may be right, too. But does it mean on that exact day? Or could it be earlier? Rusty thought the latter. For a town full of kids overexcited about trick-or-treating, it was Halloween already. I don't care what you've got on, Stuart, Big Jim was saying. 3 milligrams of Valium didn't seem to have mellowed him out. He sounded as fabulously grumpy as ever. You infernal, get up there and take Roger with you. Huh? What? He listened. I shouldn't even have to tell you. Haven't you been watching the cotton-picking TV? If it gives you any sass, you... He looked up and saw Rusty in the doorway. For just a moment, Big Jim had the startled look of a man replaying his conversation and trying to decide how much the newcomer might have overheard. Stuart, someone's here. I'll get back to you. And when I do, you better tell me what I want to hear. He broke the connection without saying goodbye, held the phone up to Rusty, and bared his small upper teeth in a smile. I know, very naughty. But town business won't wait. He sighed. It's not easy to be the one everybody's dependent on, especially when you're not feeling well.
Must be difficult, Rusty agreed.
God helps me. Would you like to know the philosophy I live by, pal?
No.
Sure.
When God closes a door, he opens a window.
Do you think so?
I know so. And the one thing I always try to remember is that when you pray for what you want, God turns a deaf ear. But when you pray for what you need, he's all ears.
Uh-huh.
Rusty entered the lounge. On the wall, the TV was tuned to CNN. The sound was muted, but there was a still photo of James Rennie Sr. looming behind the talking head, black and white, not flattering. One of Big Jim's fingers was raised, and so was his upper lip, not in a smile, but in a remarkably canine sneer. The super beneath read, "Was Dome Town Drug Haven." The picture switched to a Jim Rennie used car ad, the annoying one that always ended with one of the salespeople, never Big Jim himself, screaming, "You'll be wheelin' because Big Jim's dealin'." Big Jim gestured to it and smiled sadly. You see what Barbara's friends on the outside are doing to me? Well, what's the surprise? When Christ came to redeem mankind,
They made him carry his own cross to Calvary Hill, where he died in blood and dust.
Rusty reflected, and not for the first time, what a strange drug Valium was. He didn't know if there really was Veritas in vino, but there was plenty of it in Valium. When you gave it to people, especially by IV, you often heard exactly what they thought of themselves.
Rusty pulled up a chair and readied the stethoscope for action.
Lift up your shirt.
When Big Jim put down his cell phone to do it, Rusty slipped it into his breast pocket.
I'll just take this, shall I? I'll leave it at the lobby desk. That's an okay area for cell phones. The chairs aren't as well padded as these, but they're still not bad.
He expected Big Jim to protest, maybe explode, but he didn't so much as peep. Only exposed a bulging Buddha belly and large, soft man breasts above it.
Rusty bent forward and had a listen. It was far better than he'd expected. He would have been happy with 110 beats a minute plus moderate premature ventriculation. Instead, Big Jim's pump was loping along at 90, with no misbeats at all.
I'm feeling a lot better, Big Jim said. It was stress. I've been under terrible stress. I'm going to take another hour or two to rest right here. Do you realize you can see all of downtown from this window, pal? And I'm going to visit with Junior one more time. After that, I'll just check myself out, and
it isn't just stress. You're overweight and out of shape.
Big Jim bared his upper teeth in that bogus smile. I've been running a business in a town, pal. Both in the black, by the way. That leaves little time for treadmills and stairmasters and such.
You presented with PAT 2 years ago, Rennie. That's paroxysmal atrial tachycardia.
I know what it is. I went to WebMD, and it said healthy people often experience.
Ron Haskell told you in no uncertain terms to get your weight under control, to get the arrhythmia under control with medication, and if medication wasn't effective, to explore surgical options to correct the underlying problem.
Big Jim had begun to look like an unhappy child imprisoned in a high chair.
God told me not to. God said no pacemaker. And God was right. Duke Perkins had a pacemaker, and look what happened to him.
Not to mention his widow, Rusty said softly. Bad luck for her, too. She must have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Big Jim regarded him, little pig eyes calculating. Then he looked up at the ceiling.
Lights are on again, aren't they? I got you your propane like you asked. Some people don't have much gratitude. Of course a man in my position gets used to that.
We'll be out again by tomorrow night.
Big Jim shook his head.
By tomorrow night you'll have enough LP to keep this place running until Christmas if it's necessary. It's my promise to you for having such a wonderful bedside manner and being such an all-around good fellow.
I do have trouble being grateful when people return what was mine to begin with. I'm funny that way.
Oh, so now you're equating yourself with the hospital, Big Jim snorted.
Why not? You just equated yourself with Christ. Let's return to your medical situation, shall we?
Big Jim flapped his large, blunt-fingered hands disgustedly.
Valium isn't a cure. If you walk out of here, you could be firing misbeats again by 5 p.m. Or just vapor lock completely. The bright side is that you could be meeting your savior before it gets dark here in town.
And what would you recommend?
Rennie spoke calmly. He had regained his composure.
I could give you something that would probably take care of the problem, at least short term. It's a drug.
What drug?
But there's a price.
I knew it, Big Jim said softly. I knew you were on Barbara's side the day you came to my office, with your give me this and give me that.
The only thing Rusty had asked for was propane, but he ignored that.
How did you know Barbara had a side then? The murders hadn't been discovered, so how did you know he had a side?
Big Jim's eyes gleamed with amusement or paranoia. Or both.
I have my little ways, pal.
So what's the price?
What would you like me to trade you for the drug that will keep me from having a heart attack?
And before Rusty could respond,
let me guess, you want Barbara's freedom, don't you?
No, this town would lynch him the minute he stepped outside.
Big Jim laughed.
Every now and then you show a lick of sense.
I want you to step down. Sanders, too. Let Andrea Grinnell take over with Julia Shumway to help her out until Andy kicks her drug habit.
Big Jim laughed louder this time and slapped his thigh for good measure.
I thought Cox was bad. He wanted the one with the big titties to help Andrea. But you're ever so much worse. Shumway? That rhymes with witch couldn't administrate herself out of a paper bag.
I know you killed Coggins.
He hadn't meant to say that. But it was out before he could pull it back. And what harm? It was just the two of them. Unless you counted CNN's John Roberts, looking down from the TV on the wall. And besides, the results were worth it. For the first time since he had accepted the reality of the dome, Big Jim was rocked. He tried to keep his face neutral and failed.
You're crazy.
You know I'm not. Last night I went to the Bowie funeral home and examined the bodies of the four murder victims.
You had no right to do that. You're no pathologist. You're not even a cotton-picking doctor.
Relax, Rennie. Count to 10. Remember your heart. Rusty paused. On second thought, fuck your heart. After the mess you left behind and the one you're making now, fuck your heart. There were marks all over Coggins' face and head. Very atypical marks, but easily identifiable. Stitch marks. I have no doubt they'll match the souvenir baseball I saw on your desk.
That doesn't mean anything.
But Rennie glanced toward the open bathroom door.
It means plenty. Especially when you consider the other bodies were dumped in the same place.
To me, that suggests the killer of Coggins was the killer of the others. I think it was you. Or maybe you and Junior. Were you a father and son tag team? Was that it?
I refuse to listen to this.
He started to get up. Rusty pushed him back down. It was surprisingly easy.
Stay where you are, Rennie shouted. Gosh damn it, just stay where you are.
Rusty said, why did you kill him? Did he threaten to blow the whistle on your drug operation? Was he part of it?
Stay where you are, Rennie repeated,
although Rusty had already sat back down. It did not occur to him then that Rennie might not have been speaking to him.
I can keep this quiet, Rusty said, and I can give you something that will take care of your PAT better than Valium. The quid pro quo is that you step down. Announce your resignation for medical reasons in favor of Andrea tomorrow night at the big meeting. You'll go out a hero. There was no way he could refuse, Rusty thought. The man was backed into a corner. Rennie turned to the open bathroom door again and said,
now you can come out.
Carter Thibodeau and Freddie Denton emerged from the bathroom where they had been hiding and listening. 8.
God damn,
Stuart Bowie said. He and his brother were in the basement workroom of the funeral parlor. Stuart had been doing a makeup job on Arletta Coombs, the mill's latest suicide, and the Bowie Funeral Home's latest customer.
Goddamn son of a bitch fucking shit monkey!
He dropped his cell phone onto the counter and from the wide front pocket of his rubberized green apron removed a package of peanut butter-flavored Ritz Bits. Stuart always ate when he was upset. He had always been messy with food. The pigs ate here, their dad was wont to say when young Stewie left the table. And now Ritz crumbs showered down on Arletta's upturned face, which was far from peaceful. If she'd thought quaffing liquid plumber would be a quick and painless way to escape the dome, she had been badly deceived. Darn stuff had eaten all the way through her stomach and out through her back.
What's wrong?
Fern asked.
Why did I ever get involved with fucking Rennie? For money. What good's money now?
Stuart raved.
What am I gonna do? Want a fucking shopping spree at Burpee's department store? That'd give me a fucking hard-on for sure.
He yanked open the elderly widow's mouth and slammed the remaining Ritz Bits inside.
There you go, bitch. It's fucking snack time.
Stuart snatched up his cell, hit the contacts button, and selected a number.
If he isn't there,
he said, perhaps to Fern, more likely to himself, I'm gonna go out there, find him, and stick one of his own chickens right up his fucking ass. But Roger Killian was there, and in his goddamn chicken house. Stuart could hear them clucking. He could also hear the swooping violins of Mantovani coming through the chicken house sound system.
When the kids were out there, it was Metallica or Pantera.
No.
Roger, it's Stewie. You straight, brother?
Pretty.